Welcome to the Vine and River podcast. Here, authorities in the world of wine help us understand the intersection of wine and water. This podcast is authored by Russian Riverkeeper, a nonprofit organization dedicated to conservation and protection of clean, fishable, swimmable, and equitably shared Russian River, one of the largest water resources in Sonoma County, California. I am your host, Lenka Davis. Welcome to the second episode of Vine and River Podcast. My guest today is Mark Greenspan, PhD, the partner and viticulturalist at Advanced Viticulture. Of the many accomplishments and credentials in the viticultural field, I will mention that Mark holds an MS in viticulture and PhD in agricultural engineering, both from UC Davis. In addition to his academic achievements, he holds a certified crop advisor and certified professional agronomist certifications, and is a licensed pest control advisor. Mark has been a member of the American Society of Enology and Viticulture for decades and has served as their president in the past. And when Mark is not busy with his consulting company, Advanced Viticulture, he also writes highly insightful viticultural columns for Wine Business Monthly. It is such a pleasure to be talking to you, Mark. So let's start with water needs of the vine. These are not the same throughout the growing season. Can you please elaborate on the timing of these water needs and why applying or withholding water in these times is important for quality and quantity of the crop, but also water use efficiency?
Sure, and thank you for having me today. That's a real complex question. I'll try to simplify it as much as I can. I believe very strongly that most growers over-irrigate their vines, so it's just a baseline amount of water that the vines need, and to really understand that is not too difficult, but it requires some sensing technologies and some understanding of where the water is going when you irrigate and where is it, how long does it stay in the soil. Beyond that, there's also the factor of rain, and we're in the North Coast, in a rather rainy climate compared to many of the other parts of California and the rest of the world, of course. Our rain is focused mostly in the winter time, so we're fortunate to almost every year, with the exception of some of the more recent drought years, to start off kind of with the reservoir full. And what I mean reservoir is the soil moisture reservoir. And so our typical approach is to let that reservoir deplete before we even begin to irrigate, for the primary reason that if the vines have as much water as they want, they're just going to grow vegetatively, and we want that to happen, but we don't want it to continue to happen at a certain point. So there is a point in time, usually between fruit set and veraison, that we want to have the shoot growth reach its pretty much its end point. And so if the vines are not stressed enough, they'll just keep growing. So we need to have some stress applied to, and I mean, when I say stress, I mean water deficit stress applied to the vines so that they stop growing and turn their carbohydrate, I guess it loosely say attention or direction towards the cluster instead of the shoot tip. That's part of the reason we want to pull back the water if we're irrigating or if we're waiting for the soil moisture to be depleted, primarily between the time of fruit set and before veraison. But there's some other physiological reasons for doing it. And this pertains more to red grapes than it does to white grapes, because there's a lot of factors that occur during ripening that affect the phenolics and the color and the mouthfeel components of the fruit that go into the wine that can be manipulated and actually enhanced by careful timing of water deficit stress. And that time frame is fairly limited. And there's still a lot that we don't know, but there's enough to know that for me to direct growers to apply that deficit stress around lag phase. So it means when the berry sets, it grows, and then it kind of stops growing for a while or slows down. And then veraison happens and the berry softens and then it grows again. And so there's that little plateau period, like a little pause in growth. And during that period of time, there's a whole lot of physiological changes going inside of the berry and the parent vine, but especially the berry. And there's an opportunity during that time to affect the expression of ripening genes. The genes code for proteins, which are enzymes, and the enzymes go on to conduct different chemical processes that will affect the flavors, the mouthfeel, the color of the fruit. And it turns out we can enhance or upregulate a lot of these genes and some downregulating some of the other genes at that time that affect maybe not the berry at the moment, but the berry down during the ripening process, so after veraison. So that's the time of the season we try to focus on for getting a target water stress. And so we want the vines to be stressed, but there's a counter to that. So during the time where we want stress, we need to control that stress. If we overstress the vines, then what happens is you can actually cause negative effects. For one, we can affect the growth of the fruit or even cause it to shrink a little bit, which is going to impact yield. We can tolerate a little bit of yield loss, but not really, and compensate it other ways. But most growers don't want to suffer a yield loss. So what we do is we try to mitigate that. We try to have a target window of water stress during that period of time, but not too much and not too little. And it's not always achievable. The best vintages we have are the ones that I think that we hit that target. And so for white grapes, it's similar, but not nearly as much because we don't have the phenolic effect that we get with stressing during lag phase, but we do need the vines to stop growing. So it's really the same for all grapes. It's just the amount of level and intensity, but the timing is very similar.
You talked about the crop quantity. Is there also an effect on the quantity of the crop the following season?
Not if it's done right. If we maintain a moderate stress, and that stress can be relaxed a little bit during a ripening, but not, we don't want it to get too crazy, because if we give the vines too much water, they'll start growing again. But if we do it carefully, that has no effect on next year. But there's definitely an effect if you overstress the vine, that will have an effect on next year's crop. That's why measurement is so important, because if you just do this by the seat of your pants and by visual observations, by the time you start seeing the visual symptoms of stress, that's usually excessive stress. So that's why we really, really rely on measurements to back up our visual observations.
I think where we are in the Russian River area in Sonoma County, and you're also in Paso Robles, this is Mediterranean climate where we have, some would call, advantage of very little rainfall in the growing season. Is what you said applicable to the regions that have more precipitation during the growing season? Is the vine a vine wherever it is?
Absolutely. It's true. I think that's why we have an advantage in California, because there's almost any other region. I guess you could say this for California primarily. There's some reasons, you know, Eastern Washington and some parts of Oregon, it's very rare to have summertime rain. But you look at it anywhere else in the world, maybe Australia might be the same, Chile might be the same. But there's very few regions in the world where they grow grapes where they don't have summer rainfall. And then some of those that don't have summer rainfall don't get a whole lot of winter rainfall either. So I think we're really blessed in coastal California, especially in the North Coast, in having enough rain in the wintertime that we don't need to irrigate very much. You know, so outside of this region, like I do work in Central Coast, it's common not to get that much rainfall during the winter. And so that's where where supplemental irrigation is a little more important in the Central Coast than it is in the North Coast. But really, a vine is a vine, was your question, and it's true. We need to control the stress regardless. And if you're getting rainfall during the summer, it's very difficult to control it. And so there are some tools, cover crops and things like that, like in the east coast of the United States, they use that to try to reduce the effect of rainfall during the summer. But honestly, that's why you don't get a good vintage in a lot of these regions. We're kind of spoiled. We have a pretty good chance of a good vintage almost every year, and largely because we don't have their summer rainfall.
How has this precipitation data changed by how close you are to the ocean that changes your humidity levels throughout the growing season in some of those foggy areas in Cambria or here in West Sonoma Coast.
The fog is great. We always like to look at the fog and say that's a characteristic of our region. And it is. It is good because it keeps us not only cool, but also keeps us not too cold. Because you'll notice when the fog rolls in, it's usually in the low 50s. And so that's a really good temperature to keep the fruit ripening, even at nighttime and during, in the morning when there's no, maybe not so much sun. Berry metabolism is active above 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And so the fog tends to mitigate that cold. So some regions that don't have the fog will get really cold at night. There's an advantage in a way that there because you're not respiring as much acid, but at the same time, you're not ripening fruit at night. So yeah, the coastal is very important. The fog itself can be a problem, especially late in the season when we're close to ripeness. And a lot of times we're growing varieties that are really susceptible to rot and split, botrytis. Pinot Noir is really thin-skinned. I was just talking to a client yesterday or day before yesterday about splitting of the small berries, and that tends to be something that happens late in the season, especially when it's foggy, because you have humidity outside the cluster and the berry wants to grow a little bit or has to manage its water. And if it really, you can only blow up a balloon so far. And those little tiny berries don't have a whole lot of volume, so they tend to split. So the fog can be detrimental, and so we have to be really careful about that, not only with protection against botrytis, but also not over-irrigating, keeping the fruit not overly inflated, let's say, with water, especially when it's foggy. And we usually do get the fog during the harvest. There's lots of other things, like you mentioned Cambria. Cambria is a very strange climate down there. I do work with a vineyard down there. The growing season is almost inverted, where it's very cool during fruit set, and then it warms up towards harvest. And so they have a hard time setting fruit. Then they have a hard time keeping the fruit on that they do have because it gets warmer towards harvest. The coastal has both positive and negative aspects, but I think overall it's good. But I think the interesting part about it is it provides many different terroirs, I guess you could say. Because there's lots of different influences of the coast, and you can see that in Sonoma County, especially the South County near the Petaluma Gap gets really blasted with wind and fog. With the north part of the county, like Cloverdale, Alexander Valley, doesn't get that nearly as much. So you have such a different climatic characteristic within a fairly short distance, and I think that makes it interesting. I think that's what makes this county interesting.
I could only think of Chile being similarly interesting and diverse to California. So now let's delve into the topics that are related to your previous PhD research, or at least loosely related. Can you elaborate on why plant and soil water status measurements are important to inform the irrigation strategy?
I could go on and on. I'll try to make it concise, but I've always believe that, first of all, we're growing the plant. So we're growing the vine's growing the fruit. And that's kind of been my opinion, was to monitor the vine. And I think earlier in my career, I just monitored the vine. And I also found that I was missing a big chunk of information there. And that got me in trouble a few times. I was introduced to the soil moisture devices and measuring the soil moisture as an adjunct to the plant stress. In the last, I'd say, 15 years, I've almost flipped everything on its head. And now I probably look at the soil moisture more than the plant, but not that much more. Only because you can kind of see a lot of patterns in the soil that infer plant stress. It gives you so much more than that. So let's start with the soil. And the soil moisture has been really key for me to understand how to read these devices, and it looks daunting, but it's not. So we call them probes. Most of these devices are probes, are like a stick with sensors inside of them. And we're looking at six different depths down the profile, usually at 8-inch intervals. So we get on 4 feet. which is a typical root system depth in a grapevine, a vineyard. And so what that does is it allows us to look at where the root activity is, where the water's being depleted, at which levels. And especially here in Sonoma County, when we have so much winter rain, and then we're trying to deplete that moisture. And growers usually want to start irrigating, at least they used to, want to start irrigating in May or maybe June. It's been a great tool for me to show them these charts and show them where the moisture is or isn't, but usually it's being depleted in the upper part of the profile, but there's still plenty of moisture down deep. And so we can wait, not irrigate for month or two, sometimes never in few cases, because we have that moisture down deep in the profile, in the vine. We can see if the vines are getting it or not. In most cases, they will get that deep moisture. And by waiting to irrigate, we're actually encouraging the vines to explore that deeper depth. If you start irrigating sooner, the vines don't really need that deep moisture, so they stop exploring the deeper moisture. So we found by delaying the irrigations and by looking at the soil moisture devices and seeing where the water still is, we can not only use less water, but we can make the vines more resilient over time. Over, you know, a few years, they'll start needing less and less water. And we can push that initial irrigation event later and later in the season. So that's one thing. But also with the soil moisture probe, when we're looking at all those depths, we can see the actual irrigation events. And we can see how far that plume of water goes every time we irrigate. Is it going 8 inches, 12 inches? Is it going 5 feet? If it's going really deep, that can be problematic because, like I said, most of the roots are in the 3 to 4 feet range. If we have anything deeper than 4 feet, we usually are dry farming. But most of our vineyards don't have that kind of a root system. So yeah, we want to know how far that water goes, because if we're pushing water past the root zone, we're kind of wasting the water. I mean, there's a chance it's going to be taken back up through capillary rise, but there's also the chance it's not. And there's also the possibility that with that water goes some nutrients. And if it goes past the root zone, then it's lost to the plant. Also potential for groundwater contamination, where irrigations haven't been really monitored and they push water too deeply and they fertilize a lot and it ends up in the groundwater. Well, that doesn't happen a lot in Sonoma County because we just don't fertilize that much. But still, the best practice is to keep that water when you irrigate to within the root zone. And then after that, we can see how long that water we just applied is retained. And so how long does it take to remove that water? And by looking at those factors, we can determine how often to irrigate, how much to irrigate by looking at how far it goes down the profile, kind of fine tuning it so it goes most of the way down the profile, maybe not all the way, at least not past the profile. And then the interval between irrigations, we can determine by looking at that spike and how long does that spike take to come down to the original level where you before you irrigated. And it takes really a lot of the guesswork out of the irrigation process. So that's the soil. Now we want the plants, still important to me. In my PhD research, I was looking at remote sensing of plant stress, because one thing I didn't want to ever have to do was to go cart around a pressure bombing a plant stress measurement device to every vineyard I worked with. Turns out I had to cart a pressure bomb around to every vineyard I worked with, because even though my PhD research was interesting, it never really parlayed into a practical tool. It probably could have been, but I just went a different direction. I went back to the pressure bomb, and I started using other devices like the pyrometer, which is a device that measures stomatal conductance, and it's a very good tool. In fact, I kind of talked about it being even a better tool than the pressure bomb, but another tool to measure plant stress. So having those two measurements was really good for me to be able to control the irrigation, but also manipulate the irrigation so that I can maintain that stress level where I wanted it, or when I wanted it, and how much. In theory, it doesn't always work that way. But we try to get those targets every year and keep them within those target window for the appropriate period of time. That was what I did for a number of years. And I was still dreaming about a sensor that we didn't have to measure physically out in the field. And so within the last 15 years, a device called, well, now they call it FluoroPulse, it's a microtensiometer, was developed at Cornell University. And I had known about this for years and went back to Cornell and saw the where they were making them, actually. This is back when they were developing them. And I was drooling over them at the time because I didn't want to have to do pressure bombs anymore. It's really impractical. I mean, these are great tools, but we were going out once a week looking at a vineyard. These devices have had the promise of not just measuring it once a week, we can measure it 7 days a week. And not just 7 days a week, we can measure it 24 hours a day. So we can see what the nighttime pre-dawn water potential is at the plant. We can see the maximum water potential. And so a few years ago, we started testing these in the vineyard and had a lot of success with them and some failures. But the company was commercialized and they're out of Davis, California. And they've been making improvements on the device and in the mounting system and even in the trunk. And they call it mating compound. So that keeps the sensor in contact with the plant. And it's measuring xylem water potential in the trunk. And so we tested them for a few years. Last year, we rolled them out. So he basically said, no more pressure bombing. We love you pressure bomb, but this is better. And so we started using this device. And it's been really great. We have probably 120, 150 of them out there in use right now. And we really like it because it's giving us daily measurements of water stress.
Would you think that this is a solution for a grower that has 5 acres of vineyard land or a grower that has 10,000 acres? Is it scalable?
Yeah, it is scalable. And I'd say, yeah, it's suitable for 5 acres. These devices aren't cheap, I'll tell you that. I think they'll come down in price over time, but they're still making them one by one over in Davis. Once they can scale up the process of assembling them, price will come down. So even now...
So who can currently afford them?
We have about 25, 30 clients are using them now. And we're adding clients all the time. So right now we have small growers. We have large commercial growers. Some of the bigger companies are having us install these. And primarily we're using these as for our own use as consultants, to provide feedback to our clients. So it's definitely an affordable for anybody who's in the premium wine sector. I think where it may not be yet scalable or not affordable is for some of the lower tier wine producers. That said, it's potentially important there too. There may be lower margins in some of the other tiers, lower tiers of wine, but there's a lot of production. And so the margins are smaller. And so maybe they have just as much need for this information as we do in the premium sector. So my familiarity is mostly using these in the premium wine sector. If you have a vineyard in the coastal regions, it's usually around a few acres to 20 acres. If you have a vineyard in the Central Valley, it's, it could be hundreds of acres. So yeah, you may need more devices, but it scales to a lot larger volume.
Of the latter device that you have mentioned, is there also an automation that goes into the irrigation strategy, or do you have to review the data and then pull the trigger?
Yeah, that's kind of where we are right now. Right now, it's our brains looking at this. So we look at the soil moisture data, we look at the plant stress, we look at the forecast, weather forecast, and then we make decisions on irrigation. Now, there are automated systems, automated valves, plenty of companies out there that we work with that can do execute our schedule that we recommend. But right now our decision base is still based in our heads. We are working slowly. I wish it was faster, but working on trying to automate that decision process. But there's so much that goes into it. It's not trivial, but my goal for the next few years is to come up with a system that's a little more automated that doesn't remove us, but at least can generate a schedule. I don't believe we'll ever want to look away and ignore it. But as time goes on, we'll be able to build a system. And it may include some artificial intelligence. That's my feeling, is it's going to have to go there. But we'll be able to create decisions based on this information in a machine. So, but for right now, it's just me grunting it out every week.
So if You are a small farmer somewhere in Hopland or Cucamonga Valley. What resources do you go to learn more about these devices? Whom do you turn to?
Well, I'm a pretty good resource because we're a consulting company, and that's exactly what we do. At least in our consulting business, we're using these devices. Like I said, we have these out in the field all over the coastal California, from Sonoma, Mendocino, down to Santa Barbara County. And we have these on telemetry devices, so we're looking at this continuously. And so if someone wants to know, we're a pretty good resource. Our website does have a little bit of information, but primarily you want to talk to one of us about this. And it's really becoming bread and butter for us, soil moisture and these new FloraPulse devices. So the FloraPulse, it's essentially an adjunct for the, or a substitute for a pressure bomb, except it's measuring continuously, and it is measuring the trunk, not the leaves. So it's a little different, but we've kind of come up with a relationship between the two and some guidelines for them. And so, yeah, there's plenty of information we could provide. The company themselves has a lot of information too, FloraPulse. You know, I think we're one of the few that actually pull it all together, and we take the soil, we take the plant measurements and the weather forecast and process it in our brain. And so I think we have a lot of experience here.
For majority of the farmers, the primary reason to use or withhold water is to achieve the adequate crop at adequate quantity and quality. There are economics of using the water, but there's also environmental cost. What is currently the cost of using water for the viticulturalists in California?
So it depends on where you are, but in this region, North Coast and in Central Coast, I'd say the majority of the water, probably above 90% of the water, is groundwater. And so groundwater has not been associated with any cost directly, because you have a well and you're pumping it. But there is a cost to pumping, and there is an environmental cost, and is in addition to a financial cost. So it's mostly dealing with energy. So it costs quite a bit to move a lot of water out of the ground and into your irrigation system. And, you know, if you're a 5-acre grower, that cost may be negligible, but if you're a 500-acre grower or a 1,000-acre grower, it's no longer negligible. You know, the energy cost is really it, and that also translates into an environmental cost, because energy, as we know, is limited. And, you know, whether it depends on how it's produced, if it's a renewable energy source or if it's not. In California, we have all over the map, there's different ways we generate energy. Some of it's renewable and clean, some of it isn't. And so, yeah, that does an impact. I don't know the exact cost of pumping water, but I did have a client recently who's a new client. It's a fairly large grower in Central Coast. We kind of told them that they're getting too long and wasting water. He was excited about that because he said that's going to save us a lot of money, which makes my heart warm, because that's exactly what we want to do. Save people money, but saving money is also saving energy, and that's important. You know, there are places where you have to pay for water. In California, surface water, and those costs are rising. It's still pretty cheap, to be honest, and then probably overly cheap. But on the groundwater side, not only the pumping costs, but SGMA, Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, is creating these GSAs, and the GSAs have a plan, and some of these will be charging growers money based on the water use. There's some questions on how effective that's going to be, or if they're really measuring the right things, but there's going to be a cost associated with groundwater just as much as anything else. So there's an incentive to save water, and I'm glad to hear that. I'm really think we're in the right time, and, you know, I've been doing this for a long time now, where there hasn't been that kind of incentive on the cost side. It's mostly been a quality side, and now we're starting to see it both ways, which is a win-win for everybody.
You brought up a very salient point that it's not just water that is the environmental cost, it's also the pumping, and depending on the source of energy that you're using, if you're generating clean energy by using solar panels in your fields or in your winery, then of course you can have less of an impact. But if you are just relying on the PG&E or your provider, and that source might not be clean. That's another layer of environmental pollution that one is adding to the environmental costs of growing grapes. Do you think longitudinally the water will just get more and more and more expensive 100 years from now? Where do you think we'll be?
Water is going to get more expensive for sure. And right now we're kind of at a crossroads, I think, in California, at least looking at the groundwater. And with these management agencies, we have to start seeing better management of the groundwater basins, because depleting them is a dead end. I think we're starting to start hitting that in the Central Valley, where we just don't have any more, and it's not replenishable. But we have to make these sustainable. It's questionable whether these new GSAs are going to be effective or not, and we don't have a whole lot of time, honestly. I think the state's giving them plenty of time, but I'd like to see something happen in my lifetime where we do reach sustainability in these groundwater basins. There's no doubt about it. Energy is going to go up, and potentially cost of water, whether you're pumping your own groundwater or buying it surface water, the cost is going to go up. It has to. My whole platform, if you will, is that growers irrigate too much because they don't know enough. And that's kind of what my whole thing is, to try to get them, introduce them to some simple tools that will allow them to realize that they're using too much water and they can get by with less and still get the same crop.
You have now about 30 vintages under your belt, and you've been studying longitudinal data on water availability. Some of that seeps into really nice reviews, yearly reviews that you write into Wine Business Monthly, where you compare the precipitation trends in one vintage to a set of previous vintages. It's always risky to look ahead, but do you have any informed position on what's going to happen with the water availability in California in the future?
I wish I was better at this. My feeling is, though, I believe we're going to see more extremes in the weather. So we're going to have more drought and deeper droughts, and we're going to have more years of excess water. You know, for a grower, it's always the drought years that are the most problematic. And I do believe that we will start seeing, if we continue on the path we're on, limitations or reduction in water availability. And so what does that mean? In some areas, you're just not going to be able to grow grapes. I hope we don't get there, but it's very possible we do. I think it depends a lot on human behavior, because we're the ones sucking the water out of the ground. The nature is not doing it. And so when it comes to groundwater, I think that's the biggest question mark. I think we can be a lot better with our water. Again, it doesn't take that much to get there. It just takes the will to want to take the first step. And I'd like to see us learn to behave better as a group.
And I think that could be viewed as a very motivating finishing thought for our interview today, Mark. But is there anything else that you think that we haven't mentioned that you absolutely think is important to mention today?
I guess I'm fortunate to work with some really good growers, but honestly, it's mostly the wineries trying to to encourage the growers to be more, to be better. I'd just like to see more of that, more from growers just wanting to do better. I think AI and some of the new technologies, sensing technologies out there, are going to make things a little easier for us, and hopefully eventually less expensive to get into. And then there'll be fewer excuses, I think.
Fewer excuses to do things right. Yeah. Thank you so much, Mark, for your time today.
Thank you, Link. It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider donating to Russian River Keeper, a nonprofit organization dedicated to conservation and protection of clean, fishable, swimmable, and equitably shared Russian River. Go to RussianRiverKeeper.org to learn more or to contribute today. Thank you.